Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
One of Paul McCartney's first albums after he ditched the Beatles was called Ram. It included this song, Ram On. Beatles fans called it a huge mistake. Barack Obama's first act after finally splitting with Republicans over health care reform is to ram a party line vote through the Congress.
I believe the United States Congress owes the American people a final vote on health care reform.
Republicans are calling this a huge mistake. The Beatles can't get back together, of course, but bipartisanship? Looks like the long and winding road has made it to a dead end. Ram on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good Thursday morning, everyone. It is March 4th, and The Takeaway is, Celeste, call me wacky, call me crazy, but I think the bipartisanship healthcare reform tour, reunion tour, is not going to happen, I think.
Well, you know, we could all fix it. Why don't we just make cooperation a talking point? Then, you know,
that
maybe
could be their
we
second
could
album.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. President Obama stepped up the pressure on passing health care reform yesterday, calling for an up or down vote on the bill in the next few weeks.
For us to start over now could simply lead to delay that could last for another decade or even more. The American people and the U.S. economy just can't wait that long.
While the president wants to see action in the next few weeks, several hurdles remain. First, the House has to adopt the Senate version of the bill, then use reconciliation to pass a package of changes. Then it would have to be sent to the Congressional Budget Office for evaluation. Meanwhile, Republicans, who are unified in opposition to the bill, can offer an unlimited number of amendments to slow the process.
The president did include several Republican ideas for this latest proposal, but it's doubtful that's enough to gain any kind of real bipartisan support. For more on that, we're joined by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
So, Todd, the Republicans seem to think that this is going to be a campaign issue for every Democrat this fall. But is it a national issue, or is it going to vary significantly from district to district, state to state? What are the numbers?
Well, every district in every state is different, and, you know, every district is different for sure. But healthcare is a big issue, but jobs is likely to be a giant issue. Nobody knows exactly what every issue in every state is going to be like. I think what Republicans are saying is they're going to try to make it an issue in every race. But there will be districts where passing healthcare by any means is extremely popular. There'll be districts where it's not. So it's going to be up to Republicans to try to make it an issue if they think it's a winner. So far, I have to point out, it has been a winner for them.
And up to Democrats to try to use jobs to sort of trump healthcare reform this fall. Todd Zwillick, stay with us. We're going to talk more about this in just a moment.
The Senate has rejected the president's proposal to give a $250 cost of living increase to people on Social Security, but the House is expected to pass a jobs bill later today. In Chile, a 6.1 magnitude aftershock rattled the coastal region last night, sending panicked people running for high ground. This U.S. embassy worker in Santiago says the chaos in the streets is mostly gone.
The security situation is quite good now, and we were just a few days after the quake. I saw over 100 long truck trailers coming in last night with food supplies.
The death toll from last Saturday's quake now stands at more than 800.
Two Pentagon stories here. Early voting is now underway in Iraq. Hospital patients and security personnel are being allowed to vote today ahead of Sunday's full parliamentary election. And Mike Mulholland, Admiral Mike Mulholland, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the U.S. military cannot continue to do the bulk of the nation's foreign policy work. He says it's time for the State Department to step up.
Because, frankly, the battlefield isn't necessarily a field anymore. It's in the minds of the people. It's what they believe to be true that matters.
Remarkably candid speech yesterday for Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at Kansas State University. Asian and European markets are down. Futures down, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,396. The S&P opens at 1,118. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,280. We're going to talk about taking the internet into your hands to shame someone else. Is it a good idea?
And also, we're talking about teachers. When we're asking you in this discussion about teachers and education, who's your favorite teacher? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site,
thetakeaway.org. Definitely.
Definitely. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We begin, as we often do here on The Takeaway, talking about health care reform. And I don't know what you thought of it. Was it a speech? Was it a set of marching orders when the president stepped in front of the cameras yesterday?
I think it was all of those things.
Yes, indeed. And certainly the idea that we are in the end game here on health care reform. President Obama pushed for health care and rallied the Democrats, saying it's time for a vote. Listen.
Reform has already passed the House with a majority. It has already passed the Senate with a supermajority of 60 votes. And now it deserves the same kind of up or down vote that was cast on welfare reform, that was cast on the Children's Health Insurance Program, that was used for COBRA health coverage for the unemployed, and, by the way, for both Bush tax cuts.
So it sounds suspiciously as though the Democrats, according to the president, shall go it alone from here on out. And if the end game is really the end game, we could be weeks away from some bill being passed. But bipartisanship, that doesn't seem to be in the cards. Todd Zwillick talked to us a moment ago. We're going to get back to him. But Dean Rosen also joins us. He's a former healthcare advisor to former Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. He's now a lobbyist who represents a number of clients with a stake in the healthcare reform debate, including doctors groups, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, and nonprofits. Good morning, Dean Rosen.
Good morning. How are you?
You know, it occurred to me, listening to Barack Obama yesterday, to ask you this morning, I mean, is there really going to be horse trading from here on out? I mean, are you going to have much of a job from here on out?
Well, I think there will be a little bit of horse trading. You know, it's a complicated set of maneuvers that Congress is going to have to go through to pass a bill. The House is going to have to pass the bill that the Senate passed on Christmas Eve, and then there's going to have to be this sidecar bill, this reconciliation bill that both the House and the Senate pass to clean that bill up and incorporate some compromises that will be key to getting votes. And it's that vehicle where there will be some changes. So there will be some activity around it for sure.
All right, and we want to get into the details in just a moment. But Todd Zwillick, is there any low-hanging fruit for health care reform consumers who are looking at maybe some change taking place? Are we looking at things that will get done first, things that will be more difficult later on?
Well, one of the things in the sidecar bill that Dean is talking about that will affect consumers directly is a demand from the House for more affordability. And what that means in English is more money to make insurance cheaper for people who have a hard time affording it. So as this whole compromise and reconciliation goes through, one major thing that could affect them is they might get more subsidies to pay for their insurance. Seniors, on the other hand, who've had this gap in their Medicare Part D prescription drug coverage ever since that passed back in late 2003, Democrats want to fill that. It's called the donut hole because it's, you know, doesn't have anything in the middle. They have a gap there. They want to fill that in either all the way or most of the way. So seniors would see some help on their drug coverage directly. That's sort of low-hanging fruit for them. What's not low-hanging fruit for the Congress, though, is that all of this stuff costs money. It's all expensive. And the other thing they have to do in this sidecar bill that Dean Rosen is referring to is find a way to pay for it. And one of the big questions on Capitol Hill, John, is how expensive is this going to get once they make a bill and send it off to the Congressional Budget Office? Is that number that comes back going to be over $1 billion again? They don't know yet.
Or over $1 trillion. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, right? Yeah, Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, sort of posed that question. Let's listen to what he had to say yesterday.
The reaction of the public to going to such lengths, such extraordinary lengths, to ignore public opinion is not going to put the issue behind them. It's going to put the issue ahead of them.
So, Dean Rosen, if this horse trading that we're talking about here and the attempt to develop policy here takes place in the backdrop of Republicans saying we're going to nail you in the fall in the election, can anything constructive really get done either on the cost question or on some of the, say, donut hole questions that Todd referred to a moment ago?
Well, I think that there will be, as Todd said, in whatever this final bill is, if it passes, which is still a big if, there will be some changes, some of which, I mean, all of which will be pretty significant, and some of which will start to take effect this year. Republicans, certainly in the party that I worked for the most part, won't be part of those changes. They're not going to be at the table. I mean, make no mistake about it. At the end of the day, in the next few weeks, as they try to construct this, it is going to continue to be a sort of a Democrat-only exercise.
And it's a bit of a head-scratcher if you try to figure out the political significance of this. I mean, if you look at polling just on the donut hole issues for seniors, there are pretty significant numbers in favor. But if you look on the cost-only kinds of polling questions, it gets to be pretty negative. So I guess, you know, it's a risk for both parties, and we're going to see how it plays. But Todd Zwillick, my main question here is, over the next couple of weeks, are we going to hear a lot more from this fellow right here?
They know they don't have the votes. They know that. So you can't take that Senate bill, that bill that came from the Senate with all the sweetheart deals in it, and even though they said you're going to strip it out, okay, and then ask members to go vote for it. Every member has probably trashed the process. So how do you ask a member then to vote for it? So they got to come up with some other kind of proposal to do that.
Now, some people listening to that might be surprised to learn, even though there's a Michigan accent there, that's a Democrat. That's not a Republican talking. Who is he, and how significant is he going to be going forward?
Democrat Bart Stupak of Michigan, and very significant. He is a pro-life Democrat and a strong pro-life Democrat, was a thorn in the side of the House leadership the first time this went around because he and a whole group of a couple, a dozen Democrats, refused to vote for the House bill until some restrictions on abortion were in there. Well, he's doing it again, and you hear him saying there, that Senate bill where he doesn't like the abortion language, he doesn't like some other things, he's saying flat out, it cannot pass the House. Mm. Now, where there's a will, there's a way, he also says, and Speaker Pelosi is a master tactician. Bart Stupak, however, is saying right now that he knows personally of 12 or 13 Democrats who voted yes before, who are voting no right now, and that some of them aren't switchable. That's what he says. Now,
right,
it depends on what they're offered, but you're going to hear a lot from him on abortion and on votes in the next couple weeks.
So, Dean Rosen, in the last minute here, let's assume there is a vote. There is some bill that comes out. Your best guess, what's going to change for American consumers, for good or ill, in your view?
Well, I think this is really the tough question, and one of the reasons the politics are so dicey for the Democrats on this, aside from all the process and procedure that the American people are having a hard time understanding. But I think the main thing is the subsidies that Todd mentioned, some of those insurance reforms and things down the road which are popular, some of those things don't start until 2013 or 2014 after the next two elections. What does start right away, because this is a costly bill, the tax increases, the Medicare cuts, and other things. And so I think what the Democrats are banking on here is that the most important thing is, right, number one, it's a political accomplishment, and number two, they can start to turn to the jobs
issue.
Right.
Lobbyist Dean Rosen, former health care advisor to former Republican Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
The Chilean military is delivering food and water to earthquake survivors. Residents cheered when troops arrived with supplies in the city of Concepcion. This U.S. embassy worker in Santiago says the U.S. is helping out by fulfilling specific requests.
So they say they need a field hospital, we'll look for a field hospital. They say they want specific types of medicines, we're going to provide those. What we don't want to do is inundate them with things they cannot use or don't have time to manage.
Staying in that region, Brazil's president says his country will not bow down to international pressure to support sanctions against Iran. He made the comment during a visit by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. More on that in a few minutes.
Back to the U.S., it looks like the fix isn't in for some Toyota vehicles. More than a dozen Toyota drivers have told federal safety officials their cars are still suddenly accelerating, even after taking them to be repaired under the recall program. Camry owner Stuart Stogel of New York says his car took off on its own after he had it repaired.
I was only saved by a few feet in about a second from going down an embankment, smashing into a brick wall.
Traffic safety officials want to hear from others who have had similar problems. Back abroad, what's being described as Germany's biggest terrorism trial in decades, four Islamist militants who were plotting to kill Americans living in Germany have been jailed. Two of the men, who are native German converts to Islam, were sentenced to 12 years in prison. The four were arrested after one of the most elaborate surveillance operations in Germany's post-war history. And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, more on that rebuff for Hillary Clinton in the nation of Brazil on her Latin American tour in just a moment.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now for some takeouts on stories we're following this week. And let's go to business first, international business. We've got Louise Story here. She's the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And on Tuesday, Apple decided to pursue its competitor, not Microsoft, HTC. It's a patent dispute. Apple says the smartphones from this Taiwan-based company are using Apple technology without permission, and these phones should not be allowed in the United States. So Apple filed a lawsuit. But that's not what's most interesting about this. Louise, explain what makes this case particularly interesting.
Morning, Celeste. So it's not a court case. That's what's interesting. This is a case between Apple and HTC, and it's in front of the International Trade Commission. And that's what is unusual. This is a body that was set up in 1916 to try to help American companies avoid low-cost imports of cheap products coming in, and it has morphed into kind of the high-tech court of choice. Now, it's not a legal court. They can't cause settlements, but what they can do is they can issue these exclusion orders, which block companies from importing technologies that infringe on patents. And so what Apple is trying to do here is block this Taiwan company from importing phones.
Now, generally, it's been the federal courts that have dealt with these kind of cases. Why would companies be going to the ITC instead?
Well, you know, the U.S. court system is bogged down. It can be incredibly long waits. And think about the speed of technology. Companies don't want to wait. They often file these in both courts, and Apple did too. But the International Trade Commission can be faster. Now, the other thing...
How much faster?
Well, it could be, you know, a few months, whereas courts can be several years.
Right.
And, you know, in a world where the technology is changing probably before the courts even get to look at the dispute, that's very important. Now, the other thing to notice here is you mentioned at the beginning, and this was, you know, not filed against Microsoft, it's an HTC, but Apple has a gripe with HTC because HTC was the first company to use Google's Android software on their cell phones. And so this case doesn't involve that, but this is also Apple taking on Google to a certain extent through this Taiwan company. And in fact, Google issued a statement of support for HTC. So that's part of where we're seeing the Apple-Google battle play out right in the ITC, the International Trade Commission.
We'll see who has the last word of the ITC or maybe the U.S. federal court system. That's Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Well, and globally, HTC is a huge, huge company,
it's very well known
all over the world. All right, so our next takeout comes from Hillary Clinton's trip to South America today. She's leaving Brazil having failed in her efforts to persuade Brazil to end its opposition to sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. At a news conference yesterday with Secretary of State Clinton by his side, Brazil's foreign minister, Celso Amorim, said Brazil was convinced there is no benefit in isolating Iran any further. The BBC's Brazilian head of the Americas and Europe region at the BBC World Service, America Martins, joins us now. Good morning, America.
Good morning, John.
This is a bold effort on the part of Brazil, and it is not terribly inconsistent with policy it's expressed in the past, wouldn't you say?
Yes, but I think it was very remarkable that Celso Amorim, the foreign minister, said what he said in front of Hillary Clinton. He basically stated that Brazil will not bow to pressure from Washington. And there are two reasons for this, John. One is that Brazil has its own nuclear interests. It's not a military interest. Brazil has no plans or desire to build a nuclear weapon, but Brazil wants to develop its own nuclear program for energy only, energy purposes only. And also Brazil wants to make very clear that it has an independent foreign policy. So that's why they decided not to accept Hillary Clinton's appeal to join the U.S. against Iran. I think it's much less about Iran and much more about Brazilian foreign policy.
Well, let's sort of connect that foreign policy with the huge sort of market issues that underlie this. Are the Brazilians defying the U.S. on Iran? I mean, are they actually actively trading with Iran? And, of course, we know that Brazilians have one of the largest arms industries in the world.
No, Brazil has good relations with Iran, but Iran is not a major trading partner. Brazil doesn't have very friendly policies towards Iran. Brazil received President Ahmadinejad from Iran last year. President Lula received him in Brazil, and President Lula is planning to go to Iran this year. But that, I think, is much more symbolic than anything else. I think it's Brazil's desire to show that it has an independent foreign policy. I don't think Brazil is going to be a very strong ally of Iran, and Brazil does not have any interest in defying the U.S. Just want to show that it has its own, a different take, if you like, in the world policy.
But Americo Martins, from our partner, the BBC, I mean, you sort of set the takeaway right there, and that is the value of doing this to the Brazilians is not in the fact that there's any sort of real economic benefit. It's that by dealing with Iran in this way, it's a very high-profile snub to the U.S. It signals very, very strongly that the Brazilians are going to go it alone.
Well, Brazil, I think, is very interested in showing that it has much more economic power now, that wants to be a regional... Well, Brazil is a regional leader. Brazil wants to have a more of a say in the world's stage. Brazil wanted a reform in the Security Council, for example. So all of this is sort of related in this Brazilian position. I don't think Brazil has any particular interest in Iran. Brazil does not necessarily feel that Iran is a friendly government. I think the position of President Lula and its foreign policy, and its foreign minister, is that Brazil should dialogue with almost any country in the world, which is a very different position mm-hmm. from the U.S., for example.
Americo Martins, Brazilian head of the BBC's Americas region, joining us from London. Where does Hillary Clinton go next?
Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
She's going to Central America to talk about the crisis in Honduras that now is coming to an end.
Very good. Thanks so much for that.
Thank you. Bye.
Coming up, in the student default rates on loans are on the rise in this economic environment, but historically black colleges and universities in Texas have developed a system that could help everyone around the nation stay creditworthy and stay in school. We'll talk more in a few minutes.
We're also going to talk later this morning about a recent survey of 40,000 teachers asking them what they need in order to improve education. So it got us thinking about the ideal teacher, what they have and what they do for you. Lots of movies with this theme.
Mr. Holland had a profound influence on my life, on a lot of lives, I know. There is not a life in this room that you have not touched.
So we want to know, who is the best teacher you've ever had? I've had lots of them. And tell us why, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, if you go 270 days without making a payment on your student loan, you are in default. And actually, there's a growing number of people who are defaulting on their student loans. That's probably not surprising, considering the economic times. What is surprising is the solution and where it's coming from. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. President Obama says he's not worried about the political blowback after calling for an up and down, up or down vote on the health care reform bill.
How will this play? What will happen with the polls? I will leave it to others to sift through the politics, because that's not what this is about. That's not why we're here.
But it is an election year, and many Democrats, especially in the House, are worried about voting for the bill. Michigan Democratic Congressman Bart Stupak tells The Takeaway.
Members aren't going to vote for that Senate bill. I don't care what they promise. I don't care what they say. If you got to vote for that bill that came out of Senate, not only was the bill bad bill by House standards, the process was so poisonous, no one wants to be associated with it.
President says he wants to see action on the bill in the coming weeks. Meanwhile, the Senate rejected the president's proposal to give a $250 cost of living increase to people on Social Security. The House, though, is expected to pass a jobs bill later today.
In Iraq, an explosion in a trash heap near a crowded Baghdad market killed 7 people this morning. Comes as some Iraqis cast ballots in early voting ahead of Sunday's nationwide parliamentary election. Insurgents have repeatedly threatened to use violence to disrupt the elections, which will help determine who will oversee the country as U.S. forces withdraw. Meanwhile, on the Afghan-Pakistan border, Pakistani security officials say they've captured an elaborate network of caves used as headquarters by al-Qaeda's second-in-command. The 150 caves and passageways carved into the mountains are impossible to spot from the air. The Pakistani military found arms and stolen U.S. Army uniforms inside. It was a little over a year ago that we first heard of U.S. Airways pilot Chesley Sully Sullenberger.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280. You can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
We're going to be in the Hudson, okay? And with that, he landed the plane safely in the Hudson River. Direct air service from LaGuardia to the Hudson River right here in New York City after a flock of geese had disabled the engines. Today, hero Sully Sullenberger is hanging up his wings after 30 years, retiring to spend more time with his family and press for more flight safety. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are down. Futures down on Wall Street as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,396. The S&P opens at 1,118. And the Nasdaq starts at 2,280. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
As the unemployment rate has gone up, so has another number, default rates on student loans. The class of 2007 showed the largest increase in defaults in 18 years. And some of the people most likely to default are first-generation college students, low-income students, and minority students. But there's a group of historically black colleges in Texas who are proving that something can change. These small schools faced closure in the late 1990s. That's when the federal government said that they had to be held accountable for the high default rates of their recent graduates. So the schools sprang into action. Here's Hassan Jamil, the Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Services at Texas Southern University.
We realized that if we've been able to counsel them more about their responsibility and how important it is for them to stay in school, that have helped us tremendously to keep our default rate low.
Joining us now to talk about this is Bronte Jones. He's the former Assistant Dean of Financial Services at Houston Tillotson College in Austin. Also, Aaron Dillon, Senior Policy Analyst at Education Sector. That's an education think tank in Washington. And she recently co-authored a paper about how historically black colleges in Texas created this model to help keep default rates low. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Bronte, you worked in the financial aid office at Houston Tillotson College in Austin, and you suddenly saw the trending of default rates becoming larger and larger. So what happened when that occurred?
When that occurred, there was absolute panic among the historically black colleges in Texas. There were seven of us who were going to be in trouble as a result of the change in regulations. So we decided to pool our resources because this was new language for us and new requirements for us. And that was the best way for us to tackle this new challenge, was to do it collectively.
What you're talking about in the change of regulations is the government saying that these schools who had higher default rates above 25%, I think it was, were going to have trouble getting access to federal Pell Grants and other student aid.
That's correct. And when you consider that over 80% of the students who were attending our colleges were on federal financial aid, the loss of that funding could have led to the demise of all of our institutions.
So you guys adopted a slogan collectively, these colleges did. What was your slogan?
We're not going down like that.
Nice. It's crisp. That's perfect.
I want to play this another clip from Hassan Jamil from Texas Southern University.
What we are trying to promote is that default is not one particular person or one area's role. We make it institutional, so everybody takes some share of the responsibility to keep a student and help them to pay for their education from our president down.
Okay, so you're making it institutional. Explain to me what that actually means. What exactly do you do? What do you tell students in order to make it an institutional responsibility to keep default rates low?
That means that everybody on the campus is involved. From the time that the student is admitted to the college, looking at what aid you package them with, a freshman experience, making sure their initial year is a very strong year, helping to retain that student, providing them with the supplemental academic support that they are going to need to matriculate to graduation. And in those instances where students separate from the institution before graduating, making sure they understand their options, helping them become gainfully employed, getting to another institution, making sure you deal with the entire student from the time they show up to the time they leave your institution.
Okay.
And that was new thinking.
Aaron Dillon, the Senior Policy Analyst at Education Sector, you've said that this could become a national model, but it seems to me like what these colleges are really doing is just telling students what it means to be in debt.
Absolutely. I mean, this story of what this group of historically black colleges did and their success in reducing default rates is very relevant to other colleges. Most importantly, it shows that there are, in fact, steps institutions can take to prevent their students from defaulting on loans, and that many of these steps aren't really very complicated. Like you said, it's really about providing students with the counseling they need on financial literacy and helping students understand debt.
Well, when they counseled one class, did that only work for that year? In other words, were the default rates only lower for that particular class of students who'd gotten the counseling?
These institutions were able to do is really keep their default rates low over time. But that required constant attention to this. So they did have to keep up counseling with every class of students that came in. And some institutions began to divert resources away once the crisis mode passed. And what we saw at those institutions is default rates began to creep back up.
Well, it's a perfect idea. I mean, you teach people about career counseling. Credit counseling is part of the same thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, Bronte, this is the same exact idea in terms of educating students about credit cards before they get a bunch of them. But it also, Bronte, this seems to me like this could be a larger lesson for the financial industry in the United States.
I think it really is important to understand that in this particular instance, these are students who hadn't had this kind of counseling before, and we had a responsibility to them. I'm actually really proud of what this group of institutions did, and I do think it's applicable to the larger community.
Aaron, Dylan, could this just learning basic financial responsibility, learning how much it will cost to pay a loan over time, is that something that the entire American financial marketplace needs to learn?
Absolutely. I mean, we're asking students to take on more and more debt, and debt is becoming a larger part of our lives generally. And so it's really important for students to understand what debt means and what it means to be responsible in repaying that.
If Citibank calls you, Bronte Jones, let us know.
Will do.
Aaron Dillon is a senior policy analyst at Education Sector. It's an education think tank in Washington. And Bronte Jones is the former assistant dean of financial services at Houston Tillotson College in Austin, now treasurer at St. John's College in Annapolis. And in fact, if you want some help on this particular issue, you can go to our site, thetakeaway.org. Our contributor, Beth Koblenner, has a guide there on how to cut through the fine print of student loans.
And now for the next few minutes, a conversation on how a vote in a House of Representatives committee could possibly be a milestone that goes back to 1915. In 1915, over a million Armenians were massacred by the Ottoman Turks. The event has been called many things: the Armenian Holocaust, the Armenian Massacres, the Armenian Relocation, the Great Calamity. What it hasn't been called, by the United States anyway, is genocide. And during a news conference in Turkey last spring, President Barack Obama seemed like he was stepping away from this issue of genocide.
If they can move forward and deal with a difficult and tragic history, then I think the entire world should encourage that.
And much of the world has encouraged that up till now, but this vote in the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives could be decisive in pushing the U.S. government to taking a more decisive stand on what happened in 1915. Joining us now is the BBC's Jonathan Head. He's the Turkey correspondent for the BBC and joins us now from Istanbul. Good morning, Jonathan. How important is this vote?
It's very important to Turkey. It's very important to the U.S. These are two countries really bound together now as allies. The Obama administration clearly sees Turkey as a very good example of a Muslim democracy, as a thriving economy, and as a key ally in this region. If this resolution goes through, don't be in any doubt, it will affect relations. It's hard for people, I think, in the U.S. to understand how this one little eight-letter word, genocide, matters so much. But this is an intensely nationalistic country, and even those Turks who understand that they do have to re-examine their history and find bridges with the Armenians are very sensitive about having that label genocide attached to them. There'll be a bad public reaction, and for sure the government will downgrade relations to some degree. How much, we don't know. What they're saying is all options are open if this resolution goes through.
You know, and there are a lot of places in the world that you visit and that you've reported on, Jonathan Head, where 1915 is sort of the present day. The border between Turkey and Armenia is still closed in most places, right?
It is. It's still closed. It's supposed to be opened. And I think that's part of what's gone wrong here. In the last couple of years, the administrations have been in the States have been able to argue, look, there has been this process going on of bringing Turkey and Armenia together. And that's put Congress off putting through the resolution that would damage that process. In October last year, the foreign ministers of both countries signed a historic agreement they would, for the first time, establish full diplomatic relations. But in the last few months, that's gone wrong. Both sides mistrust each other. They disagree about the deal. And I think the sense that the momentum's gone out of that deal between Turkey and Armenia has emboldened Congress again.
You can experience this history if you go to eastern Turkey or go to Armenia. And as I said, the BBC's Jonathan Head has reported on this many times in the past. I can understand from Armenia's perspective this is a human rights issue, the use of the word genocide. What is it for Turkey? Liability?
It's liability, it's reputation. It's a country that from the beginning of its republican history has felt very sensitive about its reputation. It's simply something Turks can't accept, even if they're confronted with the historical evidence.
Who's driving this now? What's the timing?
at the moment, the driving is very much this government itself would like a better relationship with Armenia. They are willing to have a better look at their history. They're far more open than the more staunch Republican governments in the past, but they can't carry public opinion with them. And even they're very emotional about the genocide label. They're willing to mend fences with Armenia. They're willing to go some of the distance, but if they're slapped for the term genocide, it's going to put the whole process back.
Jonathan Head, history from 1915, alive and well in our time. Jonathan Head, BBC correspondent in Istanbul.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. John, has anybody ever, you know, cut you off on the freeway or maybe swindled you out of money at a store?
Motivated my revenge genes, you mean?
That's right. And you feel like I wish there was some way I could get back at them. Well, there is a way.
Do you have a couple hours?
It's called the Internet.
Ah, nice.
It's called the Internet. We're going to talk about vigilante justice online in just a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president says his revised health care proposal includes the best ideas from both political parties. He says scrapping his plan and starting from scratch, as requested by Republicans, would be pointless.
I don't see how another year of negotiations would help. Moreover, the insurance companies aren't starting over. They're continuing to raise premiums and deny coverage as we speak.
President continues to urge Congress to approve the plan, even if it means blocking GOP filibusters. Abroad, Chile's military is stepping up its game. Troops are working overtime to get relief to those affected by Saturday's earthquake.
Voting has begun in Iraq's parliamentary elections. More than 500,000 soldiers are voting early so they can concentrate on security ahead of the main polling day on Sunday. And our partner, the BBC, brings us another story out of Iraq this morning. Doctors in Fallujah, the Iraqi town, say many children are suffering from birth defects in the city. Doctors are advising local women not to have children. Some are blaming weapons used by American forces in Fallujah for some contaminants and for some of the health problems. And here's a story breaking out of Spain this morning. Spanish authorities say they've arrested the ringleader of what is called a botnet. It was a network of millions of hacked computers from countries all over the world. BBC technology correspondent Mark Ward joins us now from London. Good morning, Mark.
Hi there.
This is a huge network of servers and computers that did what exactly?
Well, it's certainly one of the biggest. The botnet basically was run by these three Spanish guys. They basically looked over the shoulder of all the millions of people that were in this botnet and stole credit card numbers, login details, bank account details, all kinds of stuff like that.
And what were they looking for? Were they looking for identity and then selling that information? Were they subcontracting their harassing hacker sort of services to other computers?
One of the ways they made money out of this was by renting bits of it out to the real bad guys who were looking for things that they can sell or bank account details so they can go away and plunder those bank accounts and take the cash for themselves. So these guys, they had something like 13 million computers were part of this botnet, which is one of the biggest computer networks on Earth, never mind criminal ones. They divided it up, sold it out, and that's how they made their money.
And, even a dweeby sort of systems analyst might not know that their computer was part of the network because of why.
Well, that's right. In the old days, if you wrote a virus, the kids that wrote viruses tended to want to get noticed, but criminals these days want to sit in the background, watch what you're doing, and some of the stuff they write is very sneaky, and it knows where those banks, online banks, have their websites, and only sprints interaction when you start typing in that password. So they want to, typically these guys, the viruses they put on computers stay in the background and just watch what you were doing.
All right, the downfall of a botnet in Spain. Mark Ward, technology correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
High tech and vigilante justice. You recognize this theme music? Does this mean anything to you?
It's the A-Team.
That is the A-Team. If you remember the intro, if you were in trouble, nobody else could help you.
I still
and
call
if you could
them.
Find them. Right, the A-Team. Well, we have kind of a new sort of A-Team operating around the world. It's called Vigilante Justice Online. It's a phenomenon in which internet users hunt down and punish people who've done things they think are wrong. In China, it's become really common, but it also occurs right here in the United States. We've got a couple people here to talk about it. Tom Downey writes about this for this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Celeste.
list.
And for an ethical look at it, our friend Randy Cohen, author of the New York Times Magazine's Ethicist column, is here with us as
well. Randy's back.
Happy to be so.
Good morning, Randy. So, Tom, give us an example of this vigilante justice online.
So one of the big cases was a Chinese woman who posted a videotape in which she stomped a kitten to death with her stiletto heels. People saw this, they got outraged, and they said, who did this? Let's find her. And, you know, what's amazing is in a nation of over a billion, they were able to track her down. She got fired from her job. She sort of got run out of town. And, you know, that was one of the seminal human flesh search cases in China.
There was also a case of a man who cheated on his wife, and he lost his job as well.
Yeah, that was a guy, a Chinese man who worked for Saatchi & Saatchi. And what was interesting about that case, and tragic about that case, was that his wife actually wrote a private blog in which she, which was a countdown to suicide. She said, 2 months from now, I'm going to kill myself. And after she killed herself, that she had asked her friends to make that blog public. When people saw this, they were outraged at her husband, at the fact that her husband had been cheating on her, and they tracked down the husband, and he got fired from his job as well.
This is happening in China, but it's happening all over the world?
It is happening all over the world, although I would say there are some special things about it in China. One, there's a very widespread recognition of the concept among internet users. So as soon as you say these words, human flesh search engine in Chinese, people understand exactly what you mean. Whereas, you know, in the United States or other places, you have to explain it, you have to, you know, go into the details. There, it's immediately understood. And secondly, I mean, it's a kind of cultural phenomenon now. So last year there was a feature film about the human flesh search engine. There was a mystery novel. It's something that people really know about there.
Okay, so Randy Cohen, you write the Ethicist column, and you know when you hear a story about a woman crushing a kitten, that's pretty unethical. It would seem to me to be only right that people would track her down and she would get punished.
We don't need no fancy jury trial. Let's string her up right now. That's worked out so well throughout human history. Mob rule. That's a woman. Did something wrong. It seems undeniable. Whether or not this is a proper response is another question.
So what is this ever justified? I mean, is it ever okay to do this?
Vigilante law, the lack of due process, a mob bullying an individual, I think that hasn't worked out so well. I think you can play the A-Team music, but you might more appropriately discuss the Ku Klux Klan. The history of mob violence is not a pretty one.
But isn't this doesn't this bear on the decision by the company to fire her, not the people who decided to go after her online?
Both. That's what's so great about my job. I'm often confront situations when everyone acts just horribly. sure, the company should show more courage and not just respond to this kind of social pressure by firing something for something that may be socially disapproved of, but it's not a crime and certainly has nothing to do with your job. But and companies have such a great history of showing courage in the face of popular sentiment, don't they?
Well, you know, Tom, I want to play for you a YouTube video from Jimmy Justice. He's a video activist from New York City. He's pretty well known among the YouTube channels. Here he is. He loves to catch traffic cops who break the traffic laws.
You're a traffic enforcement agent, and you parked your official vehicle blocking a fire pump, and there's a fire outside with firemen out there, and they have no access to the pump? You ought to be ashamed of yourself!
So, Tom, this is a perfect example of vigilante justice, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a certain kind of vigilante justice done for amusement of YouTube viewers. That's right.
But can this kind of thing end up in making actual social change?
Here's the thing, and I think what really complicates this ethically, I mean, I agree with Randy, he's certainly right, but what complicates this ethically is the difference between the United States and China. If, you know, one of the cases was a case where a public official allegedly tried to molest a young girl, and her parents were outraged. Now, if that happens, you know, if you're in Cincinnati and the mayor of Cincinnati tries to molest your daughter, you go to the city council, you call the police. There are ways to address these grievances and ways to go after institutional corruption. But if you're in China, it's not so easy. And I think what's a little more ethically complicated is when you're in a situation where some wrong has been done and you have no means to redress that wrong. And that's often the kind of situation we're talking about here. It's not that Chinese people are more bloodthirsty or want revenge more. It's simply that in many cases they lack the means to go after people who do wrong.
Well, it's a fascinating topic. You could probably spend a lot of time talking about it, right, Randy? Randy Cohen writes the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine. And Tom Downey, you just heard, is the author of a new piece in this weekend's New York Times Magazine on cyber-possessed vigilante justice online. Thanks to both of you.
Seems like this is what the internet was made for. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org. And our fierce felines for The Takeaway Cat Show. There's some justice for you. Now the time is here to vote. Polls are open over at thetakeaway.org. You can go and cast your vote for your favorite live cat. We'll be announcing the winner on the air tomorrow. And as always, we want your suggestions for who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. Who from the news do you think is having a good and a bad week? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
And later this morning, we're going to be talking about a recent survey of more than 40,000 teachers asking what they need to improve education. It got us thinking about who's the ideal teacher? Who was the best teacher you ever had? Well, that's what we're asking you today. Evelyn in Washington posts to our site, my three favorite teachers were those I had in junior high English. All male, I had huge crushes on all three, but they also taught me a love of various aspects of reading and especially creating written communication. She made a written communication at thetakeaway.org, and we're asking about your favorite teacher at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.